I apologise for not being able to speak in Polish. I hope that was a really positive introduction. I assume it was. But Polish is one of the many languages that I don't speak. We all have that problem, if you think about it for a while. And we have the problem of sharing English as well. So I thank Marta very much and Joanna, and I thank the members of the staff of this wonderful gallery who showed us around the collections and who I've just met. And I look forward to doing more things with you in the future, if that works out. Okay, so what I'll do today is I'll talk for maybe up to around 7, a little bit past that, maybe 40, 50 minutes, and I'd love to have a conversation after that. And I'll talk about the approaches that I've been taking to contemporary art, and specifically I'll do so in relation to curating. Because one of the most obvious things happening to contemporary art all over the world today is an enormous convergence between artistic practice and curatorial practice. It's such a convergence that it's, I think, becoming one of the structural elements that's changing the nature of art itself. It's not an even business. It's not that artistic practice has one form and curatorial practice has another form, and they make a nice dialectical merge and everybody's happy. That's not the case. There's a proliferation of ways of making art today, and there's also a huge variety of ways of making exhibitions or exhibiting the work of art. The essential thing is that both artists and curators exhibit art's work. They exhibit the work that art does. That's true historically, and it's true about the present. And trying to understand that is something I'm wanting to do now, and I think that's really why I've taken up trying to think about curating in the last few years. But all of that's done in a very particular context, and what I'd like to do as an introductory framework is put a whole lot of words in front of you that just fit into the screen. I'll leave the PowerPoint here, so I'm quite happy for Marta to share this PowerPoint with anybody who wants to look at it afterwards, if that's something that the museum does. So students here, don't write things down, just look at what's up there. The fundamental approach that I have is one that recognises the coexistence of difference in the world today. Conflicted difference, but also negotiated difference, or indifferent difference, people indifferent to each other's difference. But it's the actual ground of difference that's, I think, accelerated today and operates on a much larger level, involving many more people. It also operates according to different temporalities, and changes occur not according to an overall pattern that moves modernity forward and spreads modernity throughout the world. What it does, in fact, we need a little closer to the mouth. I have to speak like that. Is that better? Sorry. Okay. What I think is happening is that we've shifted from a condition in which aspirations for modernity or to become modern, in a sense that will inevitably happen to everyone in the world, in every society, even though it'll happen at different times, that particular dream and fantasy is now very shaky and no longer a convincing way of beginning to think about the present and present differences. There's clearly no guarantee that in many parts of the world there's an aspiration to create a kind of so-called democratic capitalist market order on the model of the United States. The United States cannot manage itself cannot govern itself politically at the moment, so what kind of model is that? There are all sorts of things to be said here. But fundamentally, I'm arguing, as you'll see throughout these remarks, that we have to recognise that we're in a much more complex, much more layered, much more volatile world situation than we've ever been. And that can be debated, but we're in one, whether we've ever been there before or not. Nonetheless, when we think about what's happening today, and we think about the larger terms that we use to identify our present, to me it's very interesting that they tend to cluster around three kinds of ways. They cluster like currents in a stream. You can imagine, if you like, the past on the left of the screen and the future on the right or towards the bottom. And you can imagine this is a sort of frame around the present, particularly around the kind of ideas and terms that people use to understand the present. I'm not saying this is a picture of reality. I'm saying this is a picture of the extraordinary variety, but nonetheless structural consistency of how different peoples around the world, individuals, people in all kinds of disciplines, how they imagine the world. All these terms are pointers to what I call world picturing, right? Picturing the world and world imagining the world. So there's a cluster of classical terms that I call continuing modernities. The paradox is that through our contemporary situation, modernities of all kinds continue. And they have words that describe them, like the forces of globalization, the post-Cold War situation where the US could become a hyperpower, or the theory that we're now in a state of a clash of civilizations, as if we've gone back to the Middle Ages in some ways. Spectacularity or spectacle capital dominates in many parts of the world, but not, in fact, in most, if you look at it closely. There are neoconservatisms everywhere, neoliberal economics everywhere. There's notions of post-history, that we're in a post-historical state, that we live in a state of continually invented heritage. And there are many of what I call re-modernisms, which are efforts to revive modernism in one way or another. And then up and against those, and particularly since the 1950s and 60s, there's been this, coming from outside Europe and America, there's been this kind of transnational transitionality. And that's my terms. Transnationality is a term that is becoming quite common now to understand, if you like, the post-colonial situation that we're in. Transnationality is about connectivity across national borders, but it's also about putting your own nation into a state of transition. That's the crucial thing to pay attention to. That the idea of what it is to be a member of a national group and how that nationality might grow and change and so on, is now understood by virtually all peoples to be itself in transition and will be in perpetual transition. So this whole second current that I speak about in the middle, all of these terms are reactions against the modernities. They're all propositions about different kinds of ways of entering the present and leaving the present, moving not necessarily to a future, but moving through time. All of these are non-modern ways of actually seeing and critiquing the world. So the processes of decolonization that have gone on for decades, indigenization, which is constantly forgotten about in art world thinking, profound production of not just ways of being in the world, but artistic practice comes from indigenous peoples, and often does so in an amazing dialogue, particularly in Australia, my country, with non-indigenous practices. There's all kinds of critiques of Orientalism and the post-colonial. There are the movements that have been around for quite a long while. There's a certain postmodernism of the East, and that's meaning including this country and so-called East of Europe, where postmodernism during the 90s and after became an actual constructive positive political force, whereas in the United States and elsewhere it was a conservative negative political force within art worlds. Again, that's an example of the relative character of all of these terms, that they have a different character depending on where they are and just when. In China, there's a kind of reverse modernism going on, reverse modernization, by a kind of oscillation of modernization going on. And between those two currents, I argue, and this is sort of the philosophical, geopolitical, philosophical framework of most of the work I do, between those, if we ask ourselves, is there a fundamental change occurring in the nature of human thinking about what it is to think? Right? If there is, it's about the dialect, about dialectical oppositionality no longer necessarily being able to achieve resolutions, negotiations, or dominances, which of course was always the dream of the dialectic, and it's the dream of modernity, to be able to resolve its internal dialectical contradictions and produce an ideal communism or an ideal society, which will then be disrupted and so on and so forth. But that process itself operates in effect between the first two currents, but it does not operate between those two and the third set of currents that I draw attention to. Instead, there are antinomies, and there are frictions occurring between them, and they're antinomic. So what I call contemporaneities is the situation where we have, as I said before, this contemporaneousness of difference. Difference is not just small difference. Difference is incommensurable difference. Incommensurably different ways of being human, which coexist in the world today and generate different senses of history, different ways of self-understanding, different ways of wishing for change, different modes of revolution. And within that, there are many other things that are obvious, like self-fashioning within situations of what I call immediation. Immediation is to be immersed in media. Social media is an example of being constantly immersed in media. And what's being reached for within that framework, I think, is a kind of cosmopolitanism, it's often called, or a sense of a planetary consciousness. And in the old sense, that was a desire for a kind of world citizenship, a sort of world government, a world being. But at the moment, given this difference that I've just been laying out for you, and it's very likely continuance and indeed proliferation, it's the business of connecting, of affiliating when that's possible and when it's necessary to do so, that becomes the major mode of practice. Whoa, can I blow something? Cool. Maybe I'll leave. That one works? Can you hear? Okay, thanks. So all of these ideas were laid out in this book, the title of which is on the screen, that I edited with Oakwood Wazor and Nancy Condi. If you get a chance to check it out, it's got amazing essays by Antonio Negri, Boris Gouris, Rosson Krauss, a whole range of younger people who are also extremely interesting writers. And that's where we tackled this question of contemporaneity as a world condition. And the last generalisation I'll make along on that kind of level is that I think we're looking at a world condition, a condition and state of being, rather than a formation that integrates the social, the cultural, economic and the personal, as modernity did. Okay, we've entered a condition, possibly a condition within which we will never have huge narratives and huge overriding connective viewpoints like we did during the modern period. So that's sad, but that's just how it is. If you relate this to ways of thinking about art, what's typically done by art historians, critics, museum curators, people who organise the layout of galleries and museums, they're always actually based on usually trying to tell the narrative you see on the right-hand side of the screen there, but there's usually it's usually formed with reference to some version or another of a description of the state of social and personal being. Modernity has all sorts of complex relationships to modern art in general, to different kind of realisms, etc., etc. Post-modernity, post-modernism, and various efforts to come up with terms of being more general, but they failed. Just as post-modernity is a kind of interregnum between modernity and the present, most of those terms are fading away and disappearing. Contemporary art is the term that, as you well know, is used for, has been used since the 80s for art of the present. It's read back sometimes to the 60s, but we all know that it's contemporary art. What we're starting to become very aware of, I hope, particularly if you read my material, is that there are three or four different kinds of contemporary art that are contemporaneous with each other. They, in fact, are the art of the three currents that I just spoke to you about. And they're produced by those currents and the interaction between those currents. They're not produced by globalization. Globalization is not the equivalent of modernity or postmodernity. Globalization is a particular way of organizing international capital and certain values and lifestyles related to that, certain necessities that just a few governments are supporting. It's an attempt to create a world system, but it's one that's, I would argue, failing. It'll fail for a long time, and the impacts of the failure are enormous and very dangerous, but it is failing. Something like contemporaneity as a condition is our ground, and that leads us to think about, I think, three currents within contemporary art. That's the argument that I end up putting in the book, What is Contemporary Art, that Martin mentioned to you before. And it's led me in my more recent books to try and give an account of the history of contemporary art. In other words, to answer the question, how did art become contemporary? How did art become contemporary? You have to give an historical answer to that question. It's really important to approach the present historically as if it had a precedent, as if it came from somewhere. That's an instinct that goes against the grain of a lot of people involved in the contemporary art world, particularly because the contemporary art world, from the point of view of the great markets, museums and galleries and so on, is structured so we don't ask that question. It's structured so we accept the answers to that question given by the market system and the great museums. But we should take, I think, another view. And in a way, what I'm showing you here the contents page of a book of mine called Contemporary Art World Currents that I deliberately wrote as a textbook to illustrate and demonstrate this larger argument that I'm wanting to make to you. Contemporary art, becoming contemporary in Euro-America, is a movement from late modern art to contemporary art. And I argue that all over the world, art has moved from being modern to contemporary. A paradox is that a very strong current within contemporary art are different kinds of postmodernism, such as the work of Jeff Koons and Murakami, or what I call retro-sensationism, which is like Damien Hirst, for example, a classic sensationalist Tracy Emin, artists who depend on a kind of public populist sensationalism, but virtually all of their practices are retro in character. They've actually invented nothing original as artists. They rework and recycle things in a retro way. Retro is huge. I don't have to tell you. Retro dominates music, for example, today. Remodernism, think Richard Serra, think Christian Marclay. I'll give some examples in a minute. But this is art that actually revives and renovates and tries to keep modernism alive. And that's very, very powerful in the world today. But I spoke before of transnational transitions, and they've been developing since the 50s and 60s, and their internal complexity is what has enabled contemporary art to have the various currents that it has. So a very large historical claim about the 20th century and the 21st century is that it's the internal, if you like, transitional transnationalities within each of the areas that I've listed here, including right here in this country. And we can actually see it in the exhibition that you have on here, which I think is inspired by an idea that the shifts and changes that were made by artists in this country during the 60s and 70s are a ground of present practice that's as important as art made elsewhere for present practice. This is not a view that's very widespread, because there's a massive historical disjunction between people's understanding of the 60s in almost every part of the world and their understanding of very recent practice. There's a huge 20-year gap in between the two of forgetting that's going on. I really like to talk about that in discussion, if you like, because it's a very interesting structural thing. Anyway, at this point in the discussion, I'm trying to show to you, in the way I've laid out this book, that the transnational transitions, which, by the way, occupy 2/3 of the length of the text for the first time in a book on the history of modern or contemporary art, 2/3 of this text is about places outside Europe and the United States, starting with the region we're in. East of Europe included this country at a certain point, and so on. So there's that development, and I track the movements from modern to contemporary art in each of those regions. And then I look at contemporary concerns, and it's really important to particularly look at the work of many artists now in their 30s and 40s and younger. Artists who are much more mobile in world terms, to recognise that they're not very often committed to making art that continues the history of art, that remakes modernism or modern art or even postmodern art. It's just not a big concern. I mean, it's sort of interesting, but it's not, you know, the main thing driving them. Nor are they, I mean, artists, young artists today are very interested in working in all kinds of mediums, so they're not shaped by commitment to apprenticeship and deep experience in one medium or another. Their medium, in fact, is the art world, and the worlds the art world connects with. That's the sort of medium on that level. But what they're concerned with, I think, are these issues that I call them concerns or issues. How do you pitch the world? How do you make art politically? How do you make an art that's relevant to the fact that the contract between humans and the planet has been broken, maybe irrecoverably? How do you actually make an art or contribute with others to making a not even making an art, but imagining a different world visually and through the interactive modes of that art has given us? How do you do that? And how do you develop new kinds of ways of being as a person within a world dominated by social media that's dedicated to disintegrating your sense of self and your sense of actually connecting with others in a way that will transform anything rather than become subject to that system? How do you do that? So I think far from being just whatever art's being made now and all kinds of crazy things that young artists do, listen to them, whatever, there actually are a series of very concrete clusters of concerns and issues that artists are working on now. And I try and illustrate those, and they give challenges to curators. This is the book in which I treat these issues. So guess which cover design was the English edition, and guess which was the American edition of the book. So you all guessed it. The one on the right was, of course, the American edition. That's Richard Serra. His work, A Matter of Time, where he's actually trying to create a series of sculptural installations. His great leaning metal shapes, Corten steel, hugely massive things, double the height of a human walking through them. And then he put a group of them together into Guggenheim to create a kind of environment that took time to work through. So you could say he's concerned with time and temporality like any young artist. Well, yes, he is. But for him, being a real modernist, that has to be negotiated through a medium or a material, steel, and a human experience of relating to physical stuff. In other words, this is actual still sculpture. Sculpture is the beginning and, in fact, the end of the process. So he's incorporating temporality into sculpture, but only in the terms of the material itself. The image, this is work by Tracy Rose, a South African artist. This is a performance, you could say it's sculptural, because obviously it's making a pun, a visual pun on Rodin's sculpture, The Kiss, a very famous sculpture. It's in the National Museum in South Africa, Johannesburg. Performance was done after, just after the apartheid era was meant to have finished. She, her family had one Indian member. Her grandmother, I think, was Indian. Therefore, she was classified as coloured. So she's a coloured person. The gentleman there is her African American friend from the United States, who distributes her work in America, where she has a very small reputation. I hope. Now it's getting much bigger. They both gave in different ways. So the gesture does a whole lot of things to the Rodin. Who knows the Rodin? I mean, everybody does. Isn't it the whitest sculpture you've ever seen? It's so pure, the marble is so pure. I mean, it's a beautiful thing. I love looking at it. But whiteness, you know, colour is obviously kind of crucial. And but I think the really important world current idea for me here that she's making very vivid is this, you know, this is not black and white nations, but it really questions the way in which South Africa defined itself as a nation. And it's still trying to do that after apartheid, because there are huge issues as well, as you can imagine. But it does so in terms that are totally opposite to Richard Serra. It does so in terms of human vulnerability, of what it is to make yourself open to the gaze, the view of a spectator. Whereas the Serra is really about dominating the spectator's experience of movement in space. Totally different approaches. And, I mean, the publishers loved the image. I recommended the image. The Tracy Rose, the English publisher, says we'll go with it, even though they were very nervous about offending certain constituencies who had a whole lot of politically correct stuff. You'll offend these people, this constituency. I said, too bad, offend them. And on the other, but in the United States, you can't even begin a conversation where someone might end up being offended. You know, it's all over. That possibility is done. So I didn't win that argument. Anyway. So thinking contemporary curating, how do all these things, all these questions relate to curating? Now, I said before, right at the beginning, the curating has become a practice. It's becoming much more intensely artistic in character. And that's sort of nerve-making and contentious. But from the other side, artistic practice has become much more curatorial in character. And we've got this exhibitionary conjunction going on. It's not within the larger argument. It's obvious that exhibitionary cultures are becoming more dominant. I mean, you've just got to walk out the front door, and that massive thing that was built during the Soviet period is clearly an effort to concentrate an exhibitionary culture in one place so that everything gathers towards the landmark, gathers towards the central figure, and it spreads out like a church or something, you know, one view of the world that has, you know, huge coherences to it. Whereas Capital does another thing, it exhibits itself all over any site that you can see anywhere you go. It's just got a different framework. Both wish to dominate our visual horizons and our sense of space and place by really utterly different logics. Neither of them are going to succeed, and they're both failing all around us, but they're still trying very hard to do it. So what does that do to the way curators might think about their role, what they can do, what curators can do as curators in institutions and as independent curators and as workers within the culture at large? So that the reason I did the Thinking Contemporary Curating book was really to try and give something back to all the curators who've over 40 years given produced exhibitions that is a result of their thinking about an issue, often an issue within the history of art, often a question about a certain artist, sometimes a question within the society at large, and sometimes a kind of conceptual question, very rarely, but sometimes. But if you work, as I did for many years, as an art critic, you happily walk into an exhibition and you have no consciousness that some works of art can't be borrowed. Sometimes people won't lend them. Sometimes they're in another exhibition somewhere else. So you have this ideal representation of this artist in mind, or an ideal way of exhibiting a particular theme, and usually you have it in mind like a book that you could write on that theme. Now there's a kind of disjunction going on here. And so what I realised over, it took me a long while to realise this, but it's really most art critics, most art historians, and obviously members of the public, learn about art primarily through exhibitions. It sounds a totally trivial thing to say, but we actually do. And exhibitions also are places where our minds are changed about the history of art and the nature of the work of a certain artist. For example, I just came from London where they have the most wonderful exhibition of Mira Shendel at the Tate Modern. I highly recommend it. And I, since I was very young and saw some photographs of her installation at the 1968 Venice Biennale, where she hung these transparencies, this kind of these texts that are kind of like broken concrete poems, that are so opposite to the way this wall was thought about, we have managed to think about it. But they're profoundly subtle things, and she created this environment of transparency, presence and absence, of concepts of different worlds, again, of different ways of being in the world. I've always regretted that I wasn't young enough to go to Venice in 1968 to see that show, you know. But they've actually recreated a whole room with exactly those works and sort of marked it off and kept everything else out. So you can have this extraordinary sort of moment of imaginary moving yourself back through time. It's something an exhibition can do that a book can't do. A book can just write about that and show you some pictures, but an exhibition can actually take you in and out of that particular moment, which was so transformatory in the history of art, as of course was When Attitudes Become Form, and that's retrospectively become a sort of changing point, a quintessential shift in curatorial practice. That happened in 1969, so it's totally bizarre but also deeply wonderful to see works from that show in Venice at the moment put inside an 18th century palazzo which has got so nothing to do with that kind of art, that the disjunction between them is quite extraordinary, and I'm very happy to elaborate that in discussion if you like. Anyway, these are acts of curating, acts of exhibition making, that are actually impossible to do in books and verbally, you know, in discussion. You can sort of evoke them, and you can really talk about it in lots of detail, but you can't actually create a physical sense of, as it were, being in that space, or what it might have been like to actually be in that space. As an entirely new environment, or an entirely new kind of place was created by that artist or that curator, or the artists and curators working together. This is what I call re-curating. I mean, it's the deepest kind of re-curating that's going on now. It's about re-exhibiting the work that art does. That's what it is. I mean, it's extraordinary, very much open to curators to do now. And that set me thinking, well, why are there no books about the way in which curators think? Because these are products of very subtle thinking. But curators have somehow over the years developed this view that they should put out the results of their thinking and then they should run away and let the exhibition have its impact. And often this is just simply a structural thing that, because usually the catalogue of an exhibition or the published material has to be ready at the time of the exhibition, but usually it has to be printed 2 or 3 months before, sometimes a long time before. And if you're working in a big museum on a big scale, you've got to send it to China or somewhere. So what you do is you try and imagine what the exhibition might be like even when, before you put it together and hung it. And you try and, as it were, preempt the conclusions or the impressions you might get when you put it on the wall. But the thing that gets sacrificed is the actual new knowledge that's created by the exhibition. That every time a curator actually puts up a thing, realises that quite a lot of things about that artist's work or that issue or that theme, but it disappears. And it's left to the art critic who's actually not looking for that, or the art historian who's not able to really look at that usually, to write about that stuff. So I'm always banging the table, curators, please write notes on what you actually learned from the show you put on. Put it out there. Or publish the catalogue months later, a year later, or publish a commentary on the catalogue. Or have a journal that the museum comments on its own exhibitions and what it's learning from them. Now, I know these are ideas that are starting to be had in this place and elsewhere, so but they're so rare. It's so rare. So curatorial thought is really articulated. Curators talk about it all the time amongst themselves, and it's fantastic. Curators can actually tell you what was on the wall of every room of most of the major exhibitions that have been had for the last 20 or 30 years. Many of my friends can do this. And their conversations are fantastic. But usually when they're interviewed, they just rattle around a few generalisations and then do the next show. You know? So that's why I've been trying to write these books. All right. I'll go quickly through the book and just with some example. The lure, every exhibition is a lure. You put out a lure to draw the person into, the viewer into the experience of learning about how art might work. What is contemporary curatorial stuff? The question came up at this conference. I see a group of people here, friends of ours. That's the bishop on the left. Oakley and some yarn over there. Had this conference called the Now Museum, and we really found that the issues that I'm speaking about were spoken about, but the responses on the part of the curators, not these particular ones, but in the audience, were very different than those of the art historians. And so Kate Fowle asked me to address that and write some notes about it, and that's what led to the book. Art curating tends to divide itself into all these professional categories of practice.
I'll list them there and you can look them up later.
Care collections,
all the way through being a museum. This is kind of an historical list that goes back through from the 15th century or even earlier up to the present. Okay. And there's also all these assumptions that there are types of exhibitions that are out there. And every exhibition you do has to take one of these forms. That's starting to change because these forms are being mixed and these forms are being substituted for each other. And as the whole practice of curating becomes more like art practice, more art-like, these categories are going to start to shift and start to break. But it's worth listing them. It's very rare to actually find a list like this. You know, just obvious stuff. But. So what this adds up to is a kind of exhibitionary complex, as I call it. In fact, Tony Bennett calls it that. An exhibitionary complex is all the institutions that predominantly exhibit things, in this case art. And they range from the Metropolitan Museum in New York, to like the Universal Art History Museum, through all different kinds of museums, until the other end of the exhibitionary complex. This is an example of it. So in Pittsburgh, a group of artists from Carnegie Mellon University create an environment, a sort of, Ricky Taravanese kind of let's eat together sort of environment, where they can also give information about the whole history of food and where the food comes from and how ecologically disastrous it is. But Americans like takeouts, and they like takeouts around the side of the cafes. So they decide to have a takeout, but where they would only sell food produced by people who are refugees from countries with which the United States is at war, which means they've got a franchise that's going to go on for a long while. These particular ones got closed down, but now they're opened up just outside my office at the university, so we can eat in a lot of places. This is the exhibitionary complex. It goes all the way down that list. Stacks of stuff. Every one of these are within the setting of many other exhibition venues, sites, and events. You know, obviously, if you get your museum across the road, you'll be part of this whole park, this whole sort of central area, which itself is an exhibition complex for the city of Warsaw. And there are many other kinds, temporal ones that go through it and so on. So, re-modernising these is classically done by the Museum of Modern Art. There are many museums of modern art around the world. One of the great challenges they have is redundancy and anachronism. Because the history of modernism is over, except as revivals and re-modernisms. But it's an incomplete history and has been badly told. So it has to be constantly retold and revisited. If you go through MoMA, it's still a Euro-American narrative. And even though artists, for example, from Brazil, like Mary Shentel, but more obviously Lidia Clark, Wojtasik, and all the others, were modernists, absolute European modernists, because Brazil and Argentina are European countries, even though they are modernists, were modernists, they appear very rarely, even at the Museum of Modern Art. So there's a lot of work to be done. When a re-modernising operation tries to deal with contemporary art, in the case of MoMA, they separate it out into contemporary galleries, and they constantly frustrate us and fail in that task because they only choose contemporary art that looks like early and modern art in one way or another. Paintings, sculptures, installation stuff that looks like sculpture in some form. Jeff Wall on the left, Julie Moreto on the right, Rachel Whitbread in the middle, Laura Salcedo. I mean, this is ridiculous. It's twice the size of the hall. The room is twice the size, but the works are all isolated as if they were modernist paintings, as if they had a kind of domestic or industrial base to them. They don't. None of them do. So it's massively misleading enterprise. Another way of doing it is to contemporize history of modernism.
or look at modernism through the history of late modern art or the transformatory period, what was they doing here? This is real. I mean, the Tate Gallery is still doing that, and it's getting worse and worse at it. For example, one of the opening sections to do with process process and so on, took us through a huge heavy-duty Richard Serra and contrasted it with a work by Niki de Saint-Phalle, where she took a rifle and shot bags full of paint and they kind of dripped down. And that was meant to show us two different kinds of process. I mean, I suppose it was like me comparing those two covers in a way, but I'm going to be self-critical. But both works were actually quite poor works by those two artists, as it happened. And it just introduced this really weird and obvious false contrast. This one's actually more subtle as a contrast, even though it too is really obvious. Point I'm making is that for places like the Tate Modern, which was really Tate Contemporary, as an environment, and as a museum and gallery, they frame their modern art holdings with contemporary art. And so all over the world now, contemporary art is being used in ethnographic museums and museums of the history of art to try and make the art of the past more interesting to viewers who have this massive concentration on contemporary art. And that's very hard to do and do well. The other approach is spectacularizing, as we've seen. That's been going on for quite a long while. And the key thing here is to produce a museum building that's more interesting than the art that's within it. That's, again, something to be carefully watched. But in another sense, it actually demonstrates the convergence of artistic practice with architecture and art with cinema. This is kind of cinematic architecture. If you think about it as a building that insists that the viewer takes journeys, not just around it physically, but around it conceptually, and follows a kind of narrative, like panning. Many of these things, I think, are very positive developments. Frank Gehry thought this was the greatest contemporary sculpture, or I say late modern sculpture of all time. But they've got their downsides as well, particularly as they serve. They locate art in the service of tourism, above all. But again, it's complex because there's nothing wrong being a tourist. We're in the business of actually learning something about the present and the complexities of the present when you might have just gone in to spend some time wandering. It's still a crucial function of museums to actually introduce and challenge viewers who may be looking for a fairly easy or simple experience, to actually challenge them and, as it were, show contemporaneity to them. Is still our fundamental task, I think. It's to do the opposite of this. This is a spectator that's so stunned by the experience of being in an exhibition called Experience that no knowledge is occurring whatsoever. This is the fantasy of the modern. The exhibition reform is changing and filling up. This is a wraparound display. It shifts from biennials, the very early biennials. One of the earliest, of course, was the print biennial in Ljubljana. People can't forget that. Crucial mid-20th century was that. And there's Havana and so on, as you see here. But by the time you get up to the present, you can't actually fit into a screen the number of biennials that there are out there. Okay, history of exhibition reforms. Underneath the framework that we're speaking about, there's an even deeper set of presumptions that an art display place
should take one of these forms, and over the centuries it has taken these forms, one after another, and gradually they've accumulated. So we have a whole museum exhibitionary complex that really is an accumulation of each of these forms. They've all turned into museums of various kinds. We keep adding new kinds of exhibitionary space to the mix, to the complex. One replacing the other, each receding into the past, each trying to expand to the present, mixing them up. But we don't have a form that is the form for contemporary art. I don't think we ever will get one. I'd be very surprised if the contemporary art, which Azoff clearly argued, is layered, diverse, contradictory, and tenable in character. If contemporary art came up with an exhibitionary form that was as deep as each of these, and that was the form that everyone followed, then I would be wrong about contemporary art. Well, everything I've said is wrong, if that happens. Anyway, there are efforts by architects to try and picture and process this diversity. This is one example. The Science Museum, when you enter from the right hand side, and you can follow your own pathway. This is no privileged pathway. It's an open source museum. Okay. The point I made before about curators and curators and artists. If I talk for maybe 10 more minutes, is that fine? Is that okay? So Brutus is an example of an artist who created this Museum of Modern Art, Department of the Eagles, and that was really a whole parody of the eagle on the Austrian flag, and in Germany, the German flag is a great big eagle. This turns out to be a parody of nationality or nationalist imagery, using only images that weren't modern. And each one of these had a label next to it saying, this is not a work of art. But the whole ensemble clearly was a work of art. Hans Harko, questioning the nature of visitors to the museum, shifting our attention to viewers, Joseph Kossuth, using elements from the museum, artists or artworks from the museum, in interplay with kind of commentary. In this case, it was about censorship of works of art throughout history. So bringing up the language context of artworks into the exhibitionary display. These were all innovations by the artist. Famous case, Fred Wilson, mining the museum, looking for imagery relating to slavery in an historical museum. And that kind of historical forgetting and remembering is becoming an exhibitionary form in and of itself. We've just seen that at Venice. The whole Venice Biennale is an exhibition about an alternative history. Well, sorry, the central official exhibition by Massimiliano Gioni in my view is an exhibition that offers us an alternative history of 20th century art by putting in on display literally 50% of the artists and works in that show were made by so-called, not even outsider artists, but by artists who were certifiably insane in one way or another. And matching those with work by artists who are pretty crazy, or at least strange. So contemporary artists, modern contemporary artists who were obsessive in one way or another, and artists whose obsessions got them basically locked up. And that was what the show was about. It's a bit like Magician Stellatare, you know. Here's all the artists from Europe who were into spiritualism in one way or another, had projective, usually fairly primitive fantasies about spiritual belief of other people. 50% of the artists were actual shamans or elders or people who had a role within their indigenous communities. So So in a certain way, I think the current Venice Biennale is a kind of repeat of that moment. So you see this example of how exhibitionary forms persist and change through history. But they're initiated by artists. Magician's Donateur was inspired mainly by a group of French artists in discussion with Jean-Hubert. Institutional critique has itself developed a kind of form of exhibition making. Totally different form. Don Judd's way of showing his own work set the style and the standard for showing minimal work. Leon Gillick exhibits the history of exhibitions, particularly official forms of exhibiting information by companies and nation states. He's turning the architecture of those kinds of displays into an exhibition form. And here we get a really close convergence of exhibitions and artworks. At the Tate at the moment, Michel Garber just finished a show where a whole series of his installations of museums of contemporary African art were on display at the Tate. And Michel Garber, G-A-B-A, has been creating installations that were museums of history of contemporary African art, including, you know, reading areas and examples of works, precisely because the infrastructure for showing contemporary art in Africa is very fragmented. There's not much of it. So he goes in and literally creates it, as many artists have done. Okay, coming towards curated contemporaneity, that's Magicians, classic moment in that exhibition. One crucial thing that's done is to revisit forgotten histories, is to show the work of people who aren't very well shown. There's Michel, there he is. One of his works I just mentioned. In this part of the world, the whole retro-avant-garde approach, the whole sort of rereading and reinvention and even creation of fictional, the fictional Malevich, from one of the artists, as I'm sure you all know, who's quite active in Ljubljana, created a sort of fictional Malevich. He was active in Belgrade at that point in 1996. And that starts to shift the history of art, or ways of thinking the history of art in a different way. The exhibitions such as these, which have looked at questions of femininity and masculinity, these actually have been matched elsewhere, and there are very much bigger exhibitions on the history of feminism in the United States, but very few of them took masculinity as a topic as well as femininity. And mostly they're about the influence of feminism as a political movement on the arts and so on and so forth. So you actually had in exhibitions like this a more subtle read of what the history was than you did in the really big shows in the States, I believe. Finally, coming up to curatorial practice now, and this is just finished with a couple of slides. This is the kind of exhibitions, modes of exhibition we're making, modes of exhibition we're meaning, I think, that the mode itself of exhibiting shows. And these are the materials, I think, that curators use to make their exhibitions out of, make their art. And a lot of them have been shaped by styles of art or kinds of art. And I've actually been showing you examples quite a lot. Pop minimalism, the whole documentational archival exhibition is a product of conceptualism. It didn't just come from the archive per se. The archive itself, the whole movement towards the archive, is an impact of conceptual art and conceptual ways of thinking about information projection. When attitudes become form is an example of an exhibition where the avant-garde finally hits the museum and tries to transform it, as opposed to wanting to destroy the museum and operate separately from it. And that sort of resonance has been with us for a long while. An anti-museum exhibition in a museum is what Manetta introduced, and that continues. I spoke about the ahistorical show, the show like Ben, that tries to take us beyond the present. Sometimes it tries to take us out of time altogether, and that's another kind of exhibition that's very powerful nowadays. The other ones I've been speaking about all the way through. I'll just show you in a second a couple of examples about the idea of the collective or the dispersed or the creative commons. You know, the museum as a kind of commons for the people of a city or a region or an area, or groups that would be useful to come to the museum to work on building their own sense of community. Why not do it in the museum? An activist moments about participation of, occupiers and exhibitionary operation. Obviously, one simple idea, two or three simple ideas, exhibit that by getting out there and occupying. So I quickly finish with examples, recurating of various kinds. This exhibition, the model is being recurated in all this is being spoken about, is if they can recreate it, there. Recurating is obviously very close to reperformance. Reperformance is a kind of curating your own history and career, which Marina Bramrich does very well. This is from when the Manetta, this is what those of you who haven't got to Venice yet, I hope this will persuade you to go. It's quite extraordinary. In the image, which of course gives you all this information, it's totally bizarre to see, you know, Barry Flanagan and Boete and Mertz, that's a Mertz work down the bottom, next to these absolutely dreadful paintings of the family that owned the building in the 18th century, treating themselves as if they were godlike royalty in their own main rooms, you know, the reception rooms. And the Eva Hessel work here at the top, all these other things. It looks totally bizarre. And it looks as if they don't make any conjunction whatsoever. But if you look at this image, this is actually the effect of the show. By the time I'd finished looking at the work and taking myself back to this work, you can see the Robert Morris there, the Flanagan, the Bruce Nauman works on the right. I'd forgotten about the whole Prada building. I'd forgotten about Zane, I'd forgotten about everything. I was totally into those works. And it's a very rare thing for the works to disappear an exhibition, particularly when it's such an obvious bit of staging. So that's it's quite a wonderful paradox, unexpected paradox, I think. Transforming exhibitions as such, transforming museums, trying to reimagine them. This is really going on under the direction of a number of very innovative directors, activism of various sorts, collective gatherings, all this kind of thing. This is from the Gallatin Galleries during the Occupy movement. Very brief and, you know, politically declared dead by all the media, but not true. So different kinds of occupying are occurring everywhere and will keep on occurring. All these things echo, and it becomes possible in places like Documenta to make exhibitions that reflect all these currents, and actually to make an exhibition about all these different ways of making exhibitions. This is a kind of meta-exhibition. And the curator had the courage to show, in effect, a picture of her own brain. In other words, all the stuff that was in her head while she tried to put this exhibition together was in this part of the thing called the brain. Very confused and very, you know, conflicted, but nonetheless, it was there. So, quite interesting process. So finally, this is the last thing I'll say to kind of wrap this up. So if we think of, when I began, I spoke about in effect, what are the terms now for the psychocultural economy? Where, of being in the world now, the world's within the larger world. What's our name for them and how do we enter them? I think we do so through the contemporaneity of difference, as opposed to them all being postmodern in some way, or all having being subject to some kind of modernity. So in that case, what are the constituents or elements of curatorial thought? What are the sort of ideas that I find and I hear curators saying to themselves? So these are kind of like, you know, notes to self, as they say in America, notes to yourself to do things differently. These are not my instructions to curators. I'm not a curator, I can't give instructions. No one can give instructions. Maybe directors could give. But self, you know, instructions to self, to exhibit artwork, to renounce reticence, you can read them. I mean, they just summarise the things I've been saying. So the whole thing, hopefully, is to curate contemporaneity in art and society, in its past, present, and the forms to come, and to do so critically. So, thanks for listening.
Thank you, Terry, for this very broad brushstroke of the contemporary art and the museums as well. And before I give the floor to the public and the questions, I have this very practical thing that I had in mind throughout the whole presentation that you just gave, is that in the beginning and just here, you are placing the contemporary as historical, some way as a historical element, there's modernity, postmodernity, and contemporaneity. And then I was asking myself, whether is the question, and this is the question that we are asking ourselves in this series, whether the contemporaneity is a question of time, but also if it isn't a question of an attitude. And when I was reading also your book, What is Contemporary Art Especially, but then other ones, I was struck by this qualities that you are, you know, giving to the contemporary art, and I took a note, and maybe I will just read it, and then it gets us back to the very beginning of your talk, and I will have this very direct and very practical question, because in your paper and in your book, very convincingly you multiply the features of the contemporary. And in your lecture, you concentrated on this feature of the difference. And in your book, you wonderfully put it like that the contemporary art has this, is a provocative tester, doubt-filled gestures, equivocal objects, tentative projections. So, everything is put in this provisional state. So you multiply these wonderful synonyms and, you know, different qualities. And my problem is, because the name of the contemporary is also crammed with three distinct connotations, immediacy and novelty, indicating a detachment from tradition, a recognition of distinct temporalities. I was wondering, how do this temporary, we can think of many contemporaries, and how do we distinguish the contemporaneities, in what ways contemporary installations differ from those modernist installations? You showed the image of MoMA, and I was thinking, how do we look at art to see the modern qualities in this art, like how to distinguish the contemporaneity in the term not of the art made just a few years ago or 20 years ago and it's contemporary, but what is this, like, what is this thing that we should look for when we look at art to see if it's contemporary or not?
There's not, the crucial thing is there's not one quality. Okay. So you can't walk into, well, you can walk into exhibiting spaces and say to yourself, this is contemporary art. But usually you're saying it's contemporary art of the first current. That's very familiar. It's not about a style, no, a style, even with internally diverse features. It's more open and bigger than that. So it's really it's the crucial thing is that it's about a kind of, I mean, in philosophical terms, it's almost, to me, it's the equivalent of, if you like, deconstruction, filling the world, filling the universe, which you can only do as a process of critique that then generates unexpected supplements and otherness that do not add up to another whole. That's the difference. So the logic isn't going to end up the same. So that's one kind of answer. The other kind of answer is that if you think carefully within the three currents, each of those currents produces a different kind of contemporaneity. Right? So it's complex, but what counts as an exhibition that's crucially contemporary in one place won't count in that way in another place. Because the priorities will be different, and in New York it's almost impossible to find an exhibition that comes out of the spirit of transnationality. They're nearly all big modernist exhibitions in one kind or another, with some exceptions, but mostly they are. You basically have to go to Brooklyn or get off the island to see art from the rest of the world. El Menatsui, who's one of the great contemporary artists of the transnational current. His work is in Brooklyn. No one on the island would show his work. So, I mean, these sound like small distinctions, but they're not. They're about dominant forms and places. So it's less a situation of coming to something and looking at it and getting all you can from the visual look of it. It's much more a situation of, and it will be more and more this situation, participating in the creation of that exhibitionary environment. So I think museums actually, and we'll always have museums, we'll probably have more and more museums, but there'll be places where efforts to exhibit up to the present are being shown. And what will proliferate throughout the culture will be places of exhibitionary contact of one form or another. You know? So I think things like Occupy and so on, and efforts to bring into museums like this issues that are crucial to groups of people, which maybe there's only, I think you'll have one of those, probably going to have a lot more of those, if that's the path you want to go. We now get to the paradox of me trying to imagine a lot of the future as opposed to a little bit of the future. Because there really is no the future anymore. That's the other more complex thing. We're entering a different sense of temporality that's going to move us from past, present, future structures into the idea that they're all present at the same time, and some of these past structures are going to take over a lot of the future,
And we have a huge effort on the part of, say, certain fundamentalists to try and transform huge areas of the world into a past. Certain pasts we would call the past. But for them, no, they're totally desired futures. They just happen to have entirely the shape and model of certain pasts. And that, you know, it's that plus the experience I've had of indigenous knowledge that really precipitated all these ideas and made me think we have to imagine, you know, going forward in ways where these utterly different, incommensurably different ways of being in the world have their purchase or have their place alongside each other in the world. It's never going to be possible, and it should never be possible, to obliterate, you know, deep religious belief or indigenous belief or whatever. Yeah. So the question touches on specific things, but then raises all these others. But I'll stop answering because I'll keep on going forever if you wind me up. Any more?
Any questions? So I will just follow up with another one that I had in mind, because like when you speak about these differences, these parallel possible worlds,
yeah,
against the modernist one narrative, mm-hmm, in the contemporaneity, when we really search for this, you know, potentialities and parallel three realities, and this whole wish of openness, this up-to-dateness of contemporary art, I think that somewhere, you know, there is a danger where when I think that we can very easily fall victim of a kind of untimely patronizing the so-called multicultural difference, you know, and the respect of the difference. Mm-hmm. And in this perspective, any criticality isn't possible.
Right.
So this is somewhere, you know, it's very interesting to see all those like possibilities that the contemporary art can give, and all these museums that you were naming in your lecture. But on the other side, like, it's important to... there's this wonderful text by Giorgio Agamben on the contemporary. When you see yourself, like, and the contemporary today, but in this larger perspective of, you know, of what will resist time as well. So I was thinking about like how to look at, like, this is also like a question that we are asking ourselves, you know, when we look through the shows. Like, which ones of these works will persist time, and then they will say something about our today. And so I was just thinking about, like, what do you think about this, you know, this uncriticality connected with the content, right, like the need and the, you know, urge for contemporaneity.
Right. Okay. My whole enterprise, but also Agamben's, is against the idea of accepting the present as it is and just being contemporary in the sense of being up to date and of the present. So that's why I keep going on about history and about layers of time moving through the present. And I've also written a lot in the material about contemporaneity in 2004. Which was actually distributed to him via Antonio Negri. And, I wrote a lot, and many of the people at the conference wrote a lot about the paradoxes of being in time and the impossibility, in fact, the absolute undesirability of being entirely of your own time, because then you're totally conventional, you're subject to fashion, and you're profoundly boring. So the person, you know, just look at the people who go to Paris Fashion Week. I mean, that's it. I mean, there's not a lot of depth there. And conversation and a sense of critical contemporaneity, forget about it. So his particular essay is a wonderful essay describing the experience of contemporaneity of, in a sense, people like us, poets and thinkers and so on, and the ability we have, we don't choose to have it, it just happens to us, the sense of being in our own time and, I think, responsible to our own time, while at the same time feeling alienated from it and other to it, is a brilliant description of that experience as a subjective experience for certain people in the world. It doesn't operate at all as the basis of a geopolitical or a global or a world picturing thing. But when it comes to art practice, it becomes relevant again, because we mustn't forget that art practice and curatorial practice and all these creative practices are only creative because they recognise the sort of forces of definition that are operating on each of us in our own times and places. But we're driven by an urge to not just oppose them per se, but to transform them and shift them and deepen them and make them more interesting and complex. That's why we do what we do. Art is curious. That's why we do it. And so you mentioned multiculturalism. Multiculturalism has failed as a social philosophy because it was taken over by neoliberals and turned into a set of entitlements for people of certain origins, an utterly uncritical program. Whereas in fact, the initial efforts to think in terms of multiculturalism was an effort to look for ways of difference so that differences could continue in societies where conflict was almost inevitable. It got reduced to membership of, you know, very simple-minded ways of being members of one group or another. But the layout of all those, that's why I keep insisting about transnationality and transitionality, you know, the provisionality. So I'll go finally back to the initial point. The reason why the installation has become the dominant form of art practice in the world today is that it marks out a space of provisionality, where ideas and things and people can enter a space and then leave it later. Precisely, it says that all spaces and all interactions from now on will be provisional. But they'll still occur, and they're still, the value is in them occurring. The value just doesn't disappear because they're provisional. So the value is in the provisionality. So it's very hard to... I think we're just putting together a different mindset. Well, it probably won't be a mindset, but it'll be a sort of processual imagination. I think we're just putting it together at the moment. There you go.
Hi. Maybe I came a little bit late. You already talked about that, but I'm moving from a government question and against accepting the present as it is. Do you think there are? I mean, can we more speak about the contextual contemporaneities rather than one contemporaneity itself? Especially, like thinking that the experience of modernity is already. We can say, like, this is an experience of modernities are already different from one place to another, and especially in Eastern Europe, right. We can easily talk about interrupted modernities, or in the case of Turkey, we can easily talk about a sort of wounded consciousness that creates this experience of time. So, because most of the examples that you were selecting were from particular places and exhibitions, that's why I wanted to ask. Especially about this topic. And do you think global, in this sense, sort of resurfaces these issues?
So can you expand the global aspect?
If the way we think about the global is how maybe I should put it in a better way, but resurfacing the issues, or rather than easing, like creating an even surface.
Oh,
for
us. Oh, I see. Yeah, yeah. So it's the examples you give, I think, exemplify my point. I mean the same thing. It's a slightly different language, but the sort of wounded modernity, or in Turkey, about which I know very little, but I've read a few things and know a few people involved in that debate, like Ezra Arkan writing about architecture, the commitment to modernizing architectural forms in Turkey, and then the creation, parallel with that, of some local forms that were modern and others that weren't. So architecture constantly negotiates this issue all around the world, official and domestic architecture in terms. We just had a conference in Cambridge called Reimagining Modernism, Mapping the Contemporary. And the one really big thing I got out of that, and I actually gave a talk on this point, so I'll give it just a one-line summary rather than a one-hour lecture. A one-line summary. I think as long as we keep framing the discussion in terms of modernisms when it comes to art, modernisms, like alternative modernisms and partial modernisms and interrupted modernisms and so on, we're going to fail to recognise what you're talking about, which are the complex efforts to create certain modernities, but not all of which were Western in style at all, to renovate traditionalisms, to continue indigeneities, and to negotiate these differences in places where they have to work together, succeed or fail. That's a much more interesting history. That's what we've got to actually write the history about, as opposed to going from one country to another, looking to see how modernist or not the work was and at which time, and whether the work succeeded in being modernist like Europe or whatever the dominant thing was in that area. Because here's another thing. In each of the regions that I wrote about in the Contemporary Art World Currents book, it just was the case that there was a culture and a society that dominated that region and set agendas for that region. Like Brazil and Argentina in most of South America, and Russia in this part of the world, and so on and so forth. China and Japan in Asia. India in Southeast Asia. So there are sort of narratives of that kind that have been going on throughout the 20, for many years, for decades, eons, centuries. But they took particular forms in the last few hundred years, and they've all influenced the shape of art that we've looked at. So I agree totally with what you're saying. I think we're talking about the same thing, slightly different words. Yeah. Anyway, thanks, good question.
Thank you. Thanks, everybody.